ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to the Wild Tales podcast. My name is Jason Fox, and on this podcast, I'm going to be speaking to some inspirational people about their lives and adventures and looking at issues like resilience, mental strength, risk-taking, and nature. A lot, basically. The podcast is presented by the Book of Man and supported by Talisker, the single malt whiskey made by the sea. My guest today is Dwayne Fields. Dwayne is an adventurer, a naturalist and presenter, was born in Jamaica but grew up in inner city London, where he was caught up in gang culture and was a victim of gun and knife crime. After one brush with death, he decided to change his life and work at his first love, which was nature and wildlife. He has since become a renowned explorer, becoming the first black British man to walk to the magnetic North Pole, and he also works with taking underprivileged city kids to experience the countryside and nature. He was awarded the Freedom of the City of London for this. We talk about this and a lot more, and I hope you enjoy it. Dwayne, thanks for coming in to the court on Kingly Street.
Absolutely welcome, Jace.
Apparently, this was called Bag of Nails. And this is where Paul McCartney met Linda.
Oh, really?
And it's also Jimi Hendrix has played on that stage.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So now I feel compelled to go on that stage and play so I can say I played on the same stage as Jimi Hendrix.
I mean,
I can't play very good.
Oh, right, I was going to say.
Like crap, I can't play. Not even like Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
See, I'm intimidated by the fact that Jimi Hendrix has played
on it. No, I'm not. I'm encouraged by it.
Are you okay? Yeah. There we go. We're already different
There's
people.
He takes up the challenge. There's some residual talent on the stage, yeah.
Well, that you might pick up.
Yeah, you'd never know.
Yeah, yeah, could happen. Right, okay, so we're here to talk about resilience, really, and where you find that from and how you sort of use it in what you do. But obviously it's more interesting to go right back to the start, really.
Oh, gosh, that's a long time now.
Originally from Jamaica.
Yep.
What can you remember about life in Jamaica?
Do you know, it's funny because I came to this country when I was 6 years old, just before I turned seven, and I remember most of like my life prior to that time.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, I do. I remember it just like it was yesterday. Honestly, I remember the house we lived in. I remember the color it was when I was 2 years old. I remember the layout. I remember the gardens. I remember the trees, the roots through the forests. I remember the roots through the fields. I remember where the river and the streams were. I remember it all.
See, I can't remember that far back in my life.
I
can remember from probably eight onwards. Yeah. I can remember school holidays and where we'd go as a family, but I genuinely cannot remember before then.
Wow, I'm a little bit of the opposite. So I don't remember much from about 7 till about 11, 12. There's moments I remember really well, but generally most of it, it's like it's a blur. Prior to everything's clear.
Do you think, because I take it your memories of Jamaica are brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that has something to do with it?
Well, you've got something called a flashbulb memory, don't you? So when something big happens, like if I said to you, Jace, where were you when 9/11 happened? Yeah. You'd probably remember that.
Yeah.
Tell me about your wedding day. You'd remember that. Those are moments that are poignant. And I just don't remember many poignant moments from about age, like I said, 7 up until about age 11, 12.
So what's the contrast between your life in Jamaica and then your young years in London?
I think the main contrast was every day was an adventure and every day was a new experience and every day was fun and I felt encouraged and I felt like, you know, the world is out there to be conquered. And it felt like every single day I left the house as a 3, 4, 5, 6 year old kid and I conquered a bit of the world. That's what I felt like. So every day to me was poignant.
See, I mean, I've never been to Jamaica. Yeah. I'd love to go. I've been to the Caribbean, but not Jamaica, and it's definitely the island that I want to go to. But why did you move to London? Why did your parents move?
My mum was actually born in London. She was born in Brixton.
Right.
Her mum died when she was quite young, so she spent a lot of time in Jamaica as a kid, and she was backwards and forwards. And when she became pregnant with me, she stayed there, had me, and then came back to London.
Okay.
To carry on, you know, working to support the family back there and all the rest of it. And I just remember one day my great aunt reading a letter which was directed to my great grandma, I know it sounds all, you know, conflicted. So my great aunt read my great grandma's letter, which was saying, you know, it's time for him to come now or to go, whichever way around it was. And I think my sister, she was already here in London. She already came over here a year or so before I did. And it was just my turn now, because first of all, my great grandma was getting really old. She couldn't support you know, a growing boy in the house. So it was about me coming to live with my mum, as you should do.
Yeah, okay, I see, yeah. So your grandma was like that.
Yeah.
He's too active, he's got to get
him out of here. But funny enough, she was the one that made me feel like it was absolutely okay to be as active and energetic and wild and free as I was. Every time I got hurt, I'd run to granny. Every time I found a new animal, I mean, I was outside all the time hunting.
I say hunting.
I'd find something. I'd discover a new animal. I'd bring it home. Wouldn't know if it's dangerous or if it's safe. I'll just bring it home.
Yeah.
And granny was the one I'd go to. I'd say, granny, look what I found. What's this? Most of the time, she'd just say, get that away from me or get it out of the house. But generally, it was like, okay, good. I'm glad you're interested in that. Go and do it over there. And it made me feel like, okay, keep doing this. It's okay to do this. It's not a bad thing. It's not a wrong thing to do.
Mm. And Jamaica's obviously, I mean, I've not been there, but it is quite, it's a colourful place, isn't
it? Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. You could spend, so where I lived in a really rural part of Jamaica. So if you imagine an egg on its side,
yeah.
I lived roughly about where the middle of that egg is.
Okay.
The middle of the egg. It's a place called Linstead. It's the nearest town to me, actually. And we lived a few kilometres outside of Linstead in a really wooded area. I remember I would eat breakfast and I'd be outdoors playing all day long. And there would be an abundance of fruit to pick. And you couldn't go hungry in that country. I've never heard of anyone starving to death in Jamaica. It just, there's food bursting off of every tree.
Yeah, yeah, awesome. And then obviously the contrast.
Oh, the contrast.
Seven, London.
So... The thing is, when I came to London, I didn't realize how different London was going to be. And let me give you a little story. So when I was in Jamaica, I remember this one instance where I saw a parrot fly into a termite's nest in a tree. And I was like, ooh, what's that? And that's how a lot of the problems in my life started, by me saying, ooh, what's that?
Yeah.
And I'd climb the tree, put my hand in this termite's nest, thinking there's something in there that keeps the parrot coming back. So put my hand in there and I pulled out this baby parrot and I went to climb back onto the tree, fell into a bush below the nest, and I was attacked by hornets which were nesting below it, because birds in tropical areas tend to build their nest next to an animal that can protect their nest.
Yeah.
So I fell into this tree, into this bush, and I was stung from head to toe by hornets, ran home, still had a baby parrot. That was okay behavior for Jamaica. When I first came here, I saw a nest. It turns out it was a squirrel's nest. We don't have squirrels in Jamaica. I remember I climbed the tree. It was like an oak tree or horse chestnut, whatever it was. And I remember climbing this tree and I was all the way up. I knew I was doing something wrong because people started to gather at the bottom.
And they were just interested
They were like, little boy, are you okay? And in a Jamaican accent, I'd say, no, I'm fine. This is something that I've done many times before.
I'm an expert.
And I remember rooting around in this tuft of leaves in the tree. And I pulled out this baby squirrel. And there's a picture of me drifting around somewhere on the internet when I was like 6-7 years old holding this baby squirrel. Now, that was unusual behavior for the UK, but it was perfectly normal. And that just tells you how different this world was to where I was coming from, and how at that time, at that age, I didn't understand how different this world was at all. We were walking past a shop and I reached out to pick up a fruit, and my mum slapped the back of my hand and said, what are you doing? I said, it's an apple. She's like, I don't have money for that. And I thought, but it's an apple. It's free. It grows on trees. So that's how big the contrast was.
Yeah.
I was told here, oh, no, don't play out the front. In Jamaica, there isn't a front or back. It's just a play area.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything's a play area. Everywhere's a play area. And again, just to give you an indication of how different the world was, I was the master of everything I surveyed in Jamaica. As a kid, you probably remember just being free and just being,
yeah,
that looks great, I'm going over there. That looks great, I'm going over there. And to have restrictions such as, don't go out when I'm not here, Don't play in the back, or don't play out the front, just go in the back. And, oh, before you go out, make sure you put this, 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 and this. In Jamaica, it's just go. We don't do like an equipment check before we go outside.
That's it. It's just free go. Run. Yeah. Free reign of the entire island. Absolutely. Wherever you can make it.
If you can make it there and back by sunset, it's yours. Go.
We've like, so you came over, basically you came over when you were seven. You're in London. Was it Hackney?
No, so we first settled in, I think it was Archway for a couple of weeks, right, okay. And then we moved to Palmer's Green for about 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And then in the early, I think it was 91, 92, we moved into Stokey, East London, Hackney.
Okay, so how old are you then?
I would have been about nine when we settled there.
And then what was your experiences of growing up in the city? You know, what, like, at that stage, you know, when you moved to Hackney, so you've done your like transitional sort of period, yep. as a really young lad.
Yep.
And then you've moved to Hackney.
Yep.
You're starting to become an influenced person, I suppose, from everything that's going on around you, whether it's in school or on the street corners.
I was influenced before I got to Hackney.
Oh, really?
The first lie I ever told in this world, I told in school, and it was because I realised that I was in a completely different place that I didn't understand, and I felt out of place. And this is in infant school. So it's infant school, and I'm 7 years old. I'm struggling to make friends. This is in Palmer's Green, before we moved to Hackney. I'm struggling to make friends. And I decided the way I'm going to make friends is I'm going to, you know, tell these kids about something I understand. I love the natural world. I love insects. I love animals. I love birds. So I went into the school garden and I rooted around and found a whole load of different insects and animals that I could put in my hands. And I ran over to a group of kids in the playground. And I was about to, you know, just look at this. This is a woodlice and she carries her babies on her stomach. And look at this one. It's a, you know, centipede. And of course, they all screamed and ran away and left me standing in the middle of the playground holding a handful of dirt and insects. And that's when I realized that, Dwayne, you know what? Maybe you being you doesn't work so well. Just keep your head down, keep quiet, and don't do anything to draw attention to yourself. In class, it must have been a couple of days or maybe a week later. I don't really have a good concept of time at the time. But my teacher said, we're going to draw our favorite TV characters. In Jamaica, we never had electricity in our house. Yeah, we never had running water. We never had gas. I didn't know what a TV character was.
You didn't need it either.
Didn't need it. Didn't need it, you're right. And I remember I copied from the kid next to me. And it was the most painful thing when my teacher came over and said, oh, that's an amazing drawing. What is it? All I knew about this drawing was it was Popeye. It was a poor drawing copied from a person who wasn't a very good drawer anyway. So I knew she was lying. It wasn't a good drawing. And I was dying inside thinking, please don't ask me anything else about this character because I just don't know. And then it will show everyone that I'm a liar and I don't know and I don't have a TV or I don't know TV characters. So at that point, that was the first time I ever lied. I said, it's Popeye. He's my favorite. And at that moment was where I was now changed. I was a changed person. First time I
worked
lied.
For you as well, I suppose. Didn't
it
exactly. Got you out of that. Sort
it got
of
me out of that
awkward situation.
Yeah. And it just that behavior, that pattern of just do what everyone else does, just whatever it takes to fit in, just do that and keep your head down. I carried that from age 7 all the way through moving to Hackney, all the way through to being 16, 17, 18 years old.
So when did it all? I mean, you've had some pretty. You've been involved in some pretty sticky situations. When did that? How did that come about? How did you sort of like get into those situations? And what was life like as a teenager in Hackney?
I've been conflicted for most of my life. Every time someone said, "Dwayne, we're going to the park or we're going to West End," I was conflicted because I'd like, well, to be honest, I'd rather be doing something up a hill or in a mountain or in wood somewhere or doing something buildings, but I'd say yes, and that created a bit of conflict. And then they'd say, let's go left, and I'd think, oh, actually I want to go right, but I'd go left because I want to keep my head down and be part of the group. I don't want to be the outsider. So I was conflicted quite a lot. And I remember one of my friends was having this video thing, this media project he was working on in an estate not too far from my house, but it's not an estate that I frequented. And we went down there, and this is the first time I was stabbed. We went down there and we were doing this music project, and some local boys came into the hall and they kind of said, oh, what's going on? Sure enough, he said, look, it's fine. We're doing a music project. It's just a scene that we're shooting. You're welcome to stay if you want to and just be part of it. As soon as the music came on, they started pushing around and just being a bit of arses.
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually he said, look, I'm going to shut it down. You guys wait for me outside. I'll just pack up and come out. So it was me and three of my friends. We were waiting by the car, and these boys came and approached my friend by the car. So I got him into the car, and I went back for my other two friends. And instead of following him, they followed me. I met with two of my friends. They followed us. They cut us off from the car, basically. We started to walk a kind of long roundabout way to get him back around to my friends. And eventually, they grew in numbers. So they went from about 7 or 8 to about 12 or 13. And they started chasing us. Obviously, we ran. And at one point, we stopped when we got to the car. They came out of a side road. And for some reason, I just seemed like the perfect target. So 5 or 6 of them approached me. And I just stopped. I said, look, I'm not running anymore. And I faced, looked dead in the eye of the one that seemed to, you know, put himself forward as the leader. I said, I'm not running anymore. And he goes, why? Are you a bad man? I said, well, I'm not really a bad man. I'm just tired. And plus, these trainers, they're brand new and they're hurting my foot. And I was always a bit of a clown. So I'd say something stupid in that maybe it's best not to say. So I always try to add a little bit of like levity to any kind of situation, because I feel like it's no point being in a crap situation and being miserable and crap about it as well. So it's like, well, I'm not really scared, but it was some Adidas. I was like, my Adidas shell toes, they're kind of hurting right now. I'm not going to run anymore. And as soon as I said that, one of them kind of pushed forward and I went to back away and I ended up getting stabbed in my lower stomach. I was lucky, and I said I was lucky. It went through my belt buckle and it went in about inch or so, didn't hit anything major. By this time, my friend's older brother, who saw us running, jumped into his car and came down, and he kind of said, get in the car. So I'm holding my stomach and trying to get into the car, and at the time it felt like a punch,
yeah,
but it went straight in there and went straight across. And I could just hear him and the other one in the front seat saying, oh my God, he's passing out. And at the time, I just looked at him. I said, no, it's fine. It doesn't even hurt. And I remember holding it. And we stopped at a bus stop, called an ambulance. And just remember being in an ambulance and making my way up to Whittington Hospital, getting a few stitches. And the next day, it was history.
Yeah.
And the next incident, which probably is the most poignant one for me, was the day when I had the guy pull a gun on me. And the biggest problem with that incident was, I mean, these are a year, 2 years apart, these incidents.
Yeah, yeah. So how old were you in, just quickly, old were you on the stabbing when you got stabbed?
I was probably about 18, 19. The truth is, I couldn't tell you what the weather was like the day I got stabbed.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can tell you, I can still remember the faces of the people that did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still remember the expressions on my friends' faces. And none of us ever carried knives. It's just not our thing. I've boxed, I've done a bit of Wing Chun. I've always been, if I've ever had an incident or had an altercation, I've always been, okay, I'll use my hands.
Mm-hmm.
Always, never once have I carried a knife. And I remember this incident where I built this moped, built it from scratch, absolute scratch. I spent 3-4 months building this thing, test drove it, crashed because I didn't build it properly. I turned left and the steering wheel went right. And I rebuilt it. Then I said to my younger brother, you test drive it, it's built properly, I promise. And
send him in as the canary.
Of course you do. That's what we all do to our siblings. That's what they're there for.
Yeah, it's true.
So I remember I built this thing and he went for a test drive on it, and some boys in a neighboring estate pushed him off of it. And it's probably something you should never do, which is walk onto an estate and demand anything, whether it's yours or not. You don't walk up to 7, 8, 9 guys and say, yeah, I'm taking that back. Anyway, I marched onto this estate and I said, look, it's my bike, I'm taking it back. And at this point, I wasn't fearful. I just remember being more angry than I ever was before. And I think I was more angry because they pushed my younger brother off of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I put blood, sweat and tears into that, Jace. I put a lot of energy, I put time, I put money, I put effort into it. I was in that shed when it was freezing cold building this bike. When it crashed, I scraped my side, my knee, my elbow. I scraped myself up. And I put everything I had into it, and for them to take it, well, for them to push him off of it to take it,
was out of order, isn't it?
It was different. It was a different feeling to anything that I'd experienced before. I've had bicycles stolen, I've been robbed before. It's never felt this personal before. And I remember I marched on there and I kind of grabbed hold of the bike and I said, yeah, I'm taking it. Sure enough, these guys were there and they were tearing it apart. And for the most part, I think they didn't expect it. it's not like I was known as, you know, some tough guy in the area. For the most part, I just said, I'm taking it. And they said, yeah, take it. It's crap anyway. So I looked around and I was picking up all the bits and pieces that they'd taken off of it. And I remember seeing this one kid, and he had one little plastic panel, which was insignificant in the grand scheme of things. But I just wanted it back because it was mine. And I went and I snatched it out of his hands. And as I've done that and turned to walk away, he's pushed me. So I turned around and I pushed him back, which is stupid, because at this point I was up. I was winning. I'd got my bike back. I hadn't been beaten up. I was winning.
It's what you do, though. Yeah. You know what I mean? When you're antagonized. Yeah, exactly.
So he pushed me and I turned around and I pushed him back. And I think he stumbled in a way which made him feel a bit small in front of his friends. And he walked away and I thought that was the end of it. And I bent down picking up all the bits and pieces of my younger brother, thinking it's about to be over, I'm going to walk off this estate, everything's fine. And I turn around, this guy's got a loaded gun. Well, he's got a gun, I don't know if it's loaded or not. He's about 4 or 5 meters away from me. And I just remember him raising the gun, and I kind of stood up and I pushed my brother to the side. I didn't even push him, I just ushered him to the side and I stepped away. And before I could say, you don't have to do that, I just heard click. And it's the weirdest thing, because when you're looking down the barrel of a gun, like, it sounds so stupid, maybe me telling you this, but when you're looking, when I was looking down the barrel of that gun, any sound that I heard sounded like that gun going off.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds so stupid for me to say, if I heard a car horn in the distance, it sounded like the gun going off. And even now, it's making me feel like, oh.
But you're the thing is, he's holding that there.
He's holding it there.
And you're expecting it to go bang, so I'm your mind will make it go bang.
Exactly. So when I've heard click, and he's cocked it back, and I've seen a bullet come out the side, and I've heard click again, I'm certain that that's it, I've been shot. Before he could do it a third time, some of the guys that was there kind of grabbed him and said, ah, it's not worth it, and took him away. And on the way back home, I remember stopping 3 or 4 times and just checking that, hold on, like, let me just check that I didn't get a stray bullet or something. And by the time I got home, I checked my phone, and there's people saying, oh, Dwayne, we heard what happened. What are we going to do? Let's get this guy. Let's get this guy. Yeah. And at that point, I remember thinking, do you know what? I don't want to get him. I'm all right. I'm here. If I go after him, I'm going to get him. I have to live with it. Get him, end up in jail, or he's going to get me. Don't want any of those, to be honest.
It's tiring, though, isn't it? Revenge and all that sort of, like, escalating the violence just seems to me, I mean, you know, from where I've come from, it just, I'm sort of done with all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So I can totally get where you come from. But I mean, it was great that you realised it at that stage and not when it was too late, I'd say.
Yeah, I think at that stage, I spent so much of my life listening to people and doing what was expected.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like I said before, someone would say, let's go down there instead of up there. And it's like, it's expected that as part of the group, you'd say yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought to myself, I can't do this anymore.
But I think a lot of that doing what the others are doing, the other people that maybe you don't want to do, you're looking for a sense of belonging. You want to belong to the people that are around you. And I think that's why you do it, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And you want to fit in, even if you don't want to fit in. But then obviously, what happened after that?
So after that, I decided, and you're right, because the human condition is that we want to be part of a society or some part of a community. It's the human condition. We all want to be, we're a social animal.
Yeah.
We all support a team. That's our team. That's our unit. That's our in-group. And I never wanted to be the one on the outside. And I learned from really, really young, I didn't want to be on the outside because I didn't like how it felt not knowing things and not having friends and being stressed and isolated. I didn't like it. So after this incident now, I went back home and I started to really just evaluate where I was and what it was that I was going to stand for. Anyway, I left. I thought, yeah, I want to do something to tell everyone that I've changed my perspective. I want to do something to show everyone that, you know, you don't have to toe the line.
Mm.
Anyway, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And a friend of mine was shot and killed about 25 meters from where that happened to me. A year and a half or so later. And the idea to do something just manifested itself again. It was like, no, you need to do something because it's getting closer and closer and closer. And I didn't want it to happen to my brother.
Mm.
I didn't want it to happen to anyone that I knew. So anyway, I said, yeah, I need to do something. So I did a little marathon. I did a Three Peaks challenge to raise some money for some organization up in the Midlands. I looked for charities that I could support. So I did a little marathon and raised some money for a charity called Mothers Against Violence or Mothers Against Guns. But it was just never enough. And I just didn't feel like it was enough. And what it was, when I did that Three Peaks challenge, that very first Three Peaks challenge.
Just quickly, I've got to stop you there. The Three Peaks challenge is nails. So it is quite a lot.
It's tough.
It's the free, for anyone that doesn't know, it's the three highest peaks in the UK. That's Ben Nevis, Scafell Pike in the Lake District, and Mount Snowdon in North Wales.
Yep.
And you've got to do it, including the travel, in 24 hours.
Exactly.
It's a lick.
And you start to discover new muscles that you didn't know you had before, don't you? Yeah. But so I did that and I thought, ooh, do you know what? It's painful, it's agony, but it feels good. It feels like where I belong.
Yeah.
And I started to spend more time out in places like the marshes, Epping Forest, and then so the chronology here is slightly different. So I decided to do these things. My friend was shot, and then I decided I need to do more.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it was a catalyst to increase the intensity of what you're doing.
Yes, exactly. And I remember when I decided I had to do more, I saw Ben Fogle and James Cracknell on BBC Breakfast saying, oh, we've just rolled across the Atlantic.
I remember, yeah.
Yeah, and in the next breath, they said, well, we're going to be going to the South Pole and we're looking for a third member to join the team. So I thought, it sounds like they're saying Dwayne join our team. Anyway, I kind of sat on the idea for a couple of weeks, and when I eventually decided to do it, it was, you know, well into selections, and I got an email back saying, oh, unfortunately selections have started, we can't include you now, it'd be unfair.
Yeah.
Why don't you consider going to the North Pole instead? And I thought, actually, I'm from Jamaica, a pole's a pole, they're both covered in ice. As far as I'm concerned, they're the same, so I'll do it. And I applied, and I applied to this organization that was going up there, and I thought, that's it, I'm gonna do this. And it was never about being black, it was never about being the first. When I decided to do it, I didn't know if 50,000 black people have ever done it or if none had ever done it. It was just about me making a statement to say, I'm the weirdo that likes to do things in the outdoors. I like challenging myself. I like pushing myself. I'm standing up now to tell everyone in one foul swoop, that's who I am. So when you see me doing weird things, just understand it's me. I didn't want to whisper it. I wanted to shout it.
Yeah.
So for me, that's what the North Pole was going to be about, meant to be about. And then came, you know, that email that says, okay, great, you've been accepted, now you need to fund it. And I was like, right, let me see how much I've got. And I felt in my pockets and there was nothing but, like,
it's an expensive thing, isn't it?
It is an expensive thing. I saw that figure of £22,000. I was like, oh, God, let me raid my piggy bank. And didn't have the money, so I went trying to raise the money.
Probably the hardest thing in the entire phase.
But interestingly, the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to me happened while I was training for this. So imagine I'm taking on this thing which I'm not quite sure about. I'm a little bit embarrassed by the idea. I'm like, what's this guy from Hackney?
Why are you embarrassed about the idea?
So I was embarrassed because when I first said I was going to do it, I told a few people at work, and I was working at the bank at the time. I told a few people at work, and they were like, yeah, but why? Like, that's not what Jamaicans don't do the cold. And it was always, but black people don't do the cold. And I kept thinking, yeah, we don't, but you know, it's just a bit of cold and it doesn't make a difference. It's just the environmental condition at that time, and it shouldn't be the reason why not. And I just started to hear a few whispers where people were saying, that's not what you're supposed to do, and you're not meant to. And then that same little 7-year-old kid that just learned to toe the line was starting to show itself again. So I said, you know what, don't tell anyone, just keep your head down, do it secretly. So I didn't shout about it.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Until I was ready. Now, I told a local paper because I was fed up of telling people face to face and them kind of ridiculing me, saying, "Nah, that's stupid. You're not going to do it. You're not ready for it. You're not able to do it. You can't complete." I was fed up of hearing that. So I told a local paper, that way I didn't have to face anyone. So I was still being a bit cowardly. And I remember the day it came out in the local paper, I was so ready for all the, you know, the people, the backlash,
the abuse
and the ridicule and the condemnation of the ideas. So my phone rang and it was a friend of mine saying, "Are you climbing the North Pole?" I turned around, I said, "No, idiot, you don't climb the North Pole. It's a place in the..." And I was so riled up and ready for an argument I went straight in full, you know, guns blazing. "Idiot, you don't climb the North Pole." And it was an argument before it even started. So back to what I was saying, though. The very first thing that I did, it was embarrassing because I didn't want to tell anyone. So I decided I was going to do my training in secret. And I thought, right, I need a big space. And I Googled how to train and prep for these things. And you pull tires and, you know, running, walking, carrying weights. And I thought, I'm going to do all this stuff at nighttime in Hackney Marshes where no one will see me. So I get a couple of tires, tie them to myself, start walking. It starts to ache. And you know when your training starts to ache, you start feeling a little bit bold. You're like, it's working. This training's doing what it's supposed to do. I feel like an Arctic adventurer. I'm trekking and I'm taking on the form. And I remember just as I got into that confident place, I walked around the corner. This is along the canal now. And I remember hearing the most terrifying thing ever. It was a group of boys just laughing and giggling. I was like, "Oh, shit. I don't want to walk past them. They're going to laugh at me." And just as I stopped and I was thinking about turning around, I heard someone say, "What's that and what's he doing?" I was like, "Oh God, they've seen me. There's no escape now."
All you can hear is, "What's that idiot?"
Yeah. And it was like that. Oh. And I was about 30, 40 meters away from these guys. And I had a decision to make. Do I turn around, turn tail and run? Or do I, you know, brace up, grit my teeth and walk past them? And I put my head up, built up my chest, and I decided I was going to walk past these guys. And as I started walking, I heard them laughing and ridiculing and making their jokes. And a group of boys cackling is a scary thing, and it's a terrible thing. And it's a thing that builds a weight that seems to just press you down into the floor. And these guys were just giggling and laughing and rolling around and patting each other. And I'm walking, and as I'm getting closer and closer, it seems like it's getting louder and it's getting bigger and it's getting more intimidating. And it just seemed like it was never going to end. And as I walked past them, I just looked straight forward because I didn't want to give them anything to have an issue with. I just looked straight ahead and I just got smaller and smaller, man. It was the saddest time in probably the whole preparation for me going to the pole. I got smaller and smaller as I walked away from them because I could just hear them laughing me all the way down into the ground. And that was the point where I decided, okay, Dwayne, no more training in Hackney Marshes. We'll do it. We'll do it at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at Hackney Marshes. We'll do it at 1 o'clock in Stokey, in Clisso Park, when the park's closed and there's very few people around. And that, for me, was the most terrible thing that happened in the whole preparation.
Really? It's just... The sad thing about that is they what you did is bigger and better than anything that those people might do.
Hopefully this was something that they might look at one day and say, actually, if that clown can do it, I can do something else.
Or hopefully they'll see it and see what has happened and be like, we remember that bloke.
We laughed at him, what were we laughing at? And do you know what? I don't hold it against any of them because I could easily have been that person sat there based on who I was.
I would have been that person.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But based on, we have to be honest, like the person I was when I was 16, 17, I'd laugh at someone doing something different. Not because I felt like it was the right thing to do, but because it was the right thing to do within the group setting that we
were in. It was about fitting in.
Yeah, exactly. And so I could easily, and I don't hold it against any of them. And if they came up to me and said, "Oh, I was one that laughed," I'd say, "Do you know what? Don't worry about it, because honestly, it did play a part in making me stronger."
Yeah, definitely. So that's your training.
Yep.
How long did it go on for?
The training itself went on for about 9 months, and then I realized I didn't have the money. And interestingly, they pushed this this expedition back a year, which I was like, thank God it's back a year. I've got a year to get the rest of the money. And eventually managed to save some of the money, used all my student loan, which was meant to be used on books, but I used it on that. I even took a small loan out just to make sure I had it, because I believed in the idea. I believed that this idea was going to play a part in making young people, or people that I grew up with. I was thinking really locally. I was thinking Stokey. I want people that I know to say, well, actually, if he can do that, I can aspire to be more than maybe what we're currently aspiring to be.
Yeah.
So for me, it had to happen. And it had to happen also because so many people said I couldn't, wouldn't, and shouldn't do it. And I wanted to make sure that I proved every single one of them wrong.
Awesome. So you're training. So eventually you got the money together.
Yep.
You've got the training done.
Yes.
You're feeling ready to go to the the Arctic Circle.
Yes.
The ice cap.
Yep.
Let's pick it up from there.
All right, so I'm feeling ready to go now. It's a couple of days before.
Have you bought your kit?
I've got all the kit, got all the equipment.
You've practiced packing it.
Practice packing it. I'm ready to go. I've tent routines, got those down.
Yeah.
A lot of that in Hyde Park, practice that. Perfect place to practice for the Arctic in the middle of summer. But it was, do you know what? I felt ready more mentally than I did physically and in any other way. I was in a place where I was ready for this now. This was the time where I was going to put my stamp on what I want to be in life and what I want to do in life. So anyway, we get to the airport and we fly out to Ottawa, and we fly progressively further and further north in smaller and smaller and more shaking. The airplanes, they were getting worse and worse, man. Yeah. I was like, yeah, if I make it through this, I'll definitely get to the pole. It's not a problem. And we get to Resolute Bay, and it's just this, basically it's a porter cabin. It's a couple of porter cabins stuck together in the middle of basically in within the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, I'm actually in the Arctic. And I mean, during the whole time that I was preparing, I was googling stuff, you know, extensive research, which is like 5 minutes on Google.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, okay, I remember the first black person to do this, which you tend to form parallels between you and someone you are looking at as an example of the thing that you're about to do, don't you? So I was like, the first black person to do this, he did it 100 years ago, and this is where he started from. And I'm looking around thinking, wow, oh, Huskies, oh good, Inuit, oh good, I'm in the Arctic, I'm actually here now, the hard part's done, I just need to walk 400 plus miles in that direction and I'll be there. And I just remember being in a really, really happy place, man. I remember just thinking, this feels like what I'm supposed to be doing.
Awesome. What time of year was it?
It was April.
Okay, so April.
So it was springtime. The sun was out full time. It was
pack ice is well and truly solid.
Yes, it's
though,
solid.
Isn't it?
It's well in there. And I just remember thinking, man, it's going to be daylight at midnight. None of my friends have seen this. And everything that I looked at, I just said, that's new snow. Nobody else has seen that.
Yeah.
And I was so excited about the whole thing.
How did it all start? As in the trek?
The trek itself started. So we walked about a day and a half outside of Resolute Bay, generally in a northerly direction. And I remember we all lined up. So the race is to commemorate Matthew Henson, Robert Peary, which were the first people to arrive at the North Pole, the magnetic North Pole. So we get to the official start line, and there's a shotgun to see us off. And me and my two teammates, who I love to bits now, we start walking. And we said, right, we're going to walk that way across the open ocean, frozen ocean. And I was walking, I was like, ooh, I'm walking on frozen ocean. And I got back into this kid place where I was this young kid and everything was fantastic. And I remember we were walking across the ocean. And I was thinking, oh, I wonder if this ice is thick enough. I hope it is. I've heard lots of stories about global warming. I hope it doesn't happen today. And I remember we saw polar bears, and I was like, oh God, I'm seeing polar bears in the wild.
Wow.
And every single aspect of this trip was an amazing thing for me.
Yeah.
We walked, we spent 16, 17 hours a day walking. Initially, I hated them, to be honest. Now, I'll tell you what.
Let's talk about the dynamics.
Love them. So it was my teammate Phoebe. Sorry, I'm thinking about my current teammate Phoebe. So it was my teammate Linda and Ali.
Right.
Now, we formed this team purely by accident. I joined their team. And initially in training, we were great. I love them to bits. But what it was, when we set out for the first couple of days, we were eating food, which it wasn't the same food that we were using preparing in training. We kind of swapped at the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
So I was eating less. And as you know, when you're out and you're burning calories, like on both ends,
you were shredding up.
I was getting lean.
Yeah.
And you need to eat as much as you're using. I wasn't doing that. For the first 3 days, I probably was about 2,000 calories down. By day four, I was suffering. I was stumbling and I was walking slowly, and I started to do this thing where I was blaming them for packing my pulk wrong, which is stupid because I packed my pulk. And I was like, you guys packed extra weight in my pulk. They're like, but Dwayne, you packed it. I was like, yes, well, you allowed me to pack extra weight in my pulk. And it was really tough. And I remember it was like day six or seven, we're out in the middle of the ocean basically, and I remember looking at the horizon as much as I could see of it anyway. And I stopped. I was at the front because that's the best way to avoid people when you're stuck in a group.
Yeah, yeah.
You go to the front, you're looking that way, you don't need to see them. And every time I'd look back, I'd think, I wonder if a polar bear's got one of them. And I'd look, damn, they're both there. And yeah, not yet. And I remember I stopped because for the first time I realized, hold on, these are the only two people in the current world that I'm in. So I need to be closer to them. I need to, you know, not be so hard on them and hard on myself by not being closer to them. And I remember at that moment, I kind of said, guys, look at it. You can't see anything. And from there, we were just so close. Nothing else. That you could fart in the tent.
It was like that minute of realization where you knew that the team had to pull together. Because otherwise, you're going to do it. And it's not as fun when you're on your own.
No, it's not. It really isn't. And it's so easy to go into this place where it's head down, face the front, check the compass, check the map, check the GPS every now and then. And carry on, but it's not enjoyable if you do it that way.
No, I totally get that. Just for the people that are listening,
yep.
You're on skis?
Yes. So as much as people think, Dwayne, you must be a good skier. I'm a rubbish skier. I can make it on cross-country skis. I can probably make it down a slope. Generally, I'm not a great skier. I was walking about 90% of the way to the pole.
Yeah.
I reckon about 350, 360 miles of it, I walked.
And the rest of it was just scooting along a little bit.
I shuffled along on skis, tried to make it look like I knew what I was doing.
You're pulling a polk, which is a sledge or a sled, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, it's a purpose-built sled, which that's exactly what it is. The same thing you'd pull your kid along when on a snowy day is exactly what it was.
You're carrying all your sleeping system, so your sleeping bag, your mat,
sleeping
bag, your cooking stuff,
cooking gear,
gas or fuel.
Fuel, yep. So we worked out how much fuel we'd need. We'd pack all of that stuff, the clothing, extra clothes, batteries, equipment, food, you name it. If we needed it to survive, we were pulling it along behind us.
And the food's heavy as well. When you think about how much you needed in the beginning, that polk at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, do you know how heavy it was?
It was in the region of about 100 kilos, just under 100 kilos. So that's 300 kilos or so between the three of us.
I'd say that's a pretty well-packed polk. Yeah, yeah. For how many days did you...
We were out there for 22 days.
22 days worth of food is a lot. And the fuel needed...
The fuel was probably the most expensive thing in terms of weight.
Yeah.
We were packing roughly a litre per person per day, plus a few extra for any issues. The shotgun, radio, batteries. I'm trying to think what else I packed. Yeah, when you've weighed it all up, you put your bag on there and weigh it. It's pretty close to about 100 kilos.
Which is heavy.
Which is mad heavy, man. That's more than I weigh.
When you're pulling it.
Yeah. The first 10 minutes, it feels great. But after about an hour, it's like, oh, God, I'm suffering.
So 22 days.
Yes.
You're shredded up by this stage.
Yeah,
lean as.
So I was never really a weighty guy. I've never really had much mass. But what I found was I started to see, I was able to count some extra bones from the outside of my body. I'd like up here on my chest, and, you know, I could see one or two, like, what's this bone called?
Oh, the old clavicle.
Yeah, the clavicle. I was just testing you. I knew it was
Is that the clavicle? I think it is. Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Someone will correct us if we're wrong. I could see it clearly. I could see some of my ribs clearly. I felt good.
And the environment's amazing. I mean, for the people listening, mm-hmm. explain to us what it's like when you get to the North Pole.
Oh, gosh. It's the greatest anticlimax you will ever experience. You are in the most beautiful environment you could imagine. The sun glistens off the snow, and it looks like just billions of diamonds reflecting back at it. It just looks like it. The snow... it's got this magical look about it. It sounds so unicorny, but it's just, it's a beautiful environment. The sky, when the light shines through the sky, you get the most beautiful colors breaking down. You and all of that reflecting off the ground and coming back up, and then you look up and it's like purples and oranges and greens and blues. It's amazing. It'll be like that for the whole day. And then you're walking, 100 miles is gone, 200, 300, 400, and you get to the place which is your target. And you look at that patch of ice and you're like, right, that patch of ice looks exactly the same as the patch of ice 50 miles back that way, 300 miles back.
We could have blanked
it. We could have just sat outside of town and just pretended to have made it. But it's that sense of achievement, isn't it? I remember while I was walking, I was gassing myself up. I was saying, you know, when you get there, there's going to be confetti. And when I felt weak, I'd say, oh, there's going to be a crowd and there's going to be fireworks and it's going to be great when you arrive there. And you get there and it's just a patch of snow on a grey, miserable day.
Oh, was it a grey day?
It was a grey, miserable day.
Oh, no, got it.
I used the word miserable. It was miserable. And I remember the wind was blowing and it did clear just for a moment on the day that we arrived there. But for me, it wasn't about that bit of snow in the ground. It was about all the people that didn't think they could, didn't think they should, didn't think they would, didn't think I would, should, or could. It was about saying to them, look, I did it, which means you can do it. And it means you were wrong. And if you're wrong about me, then you might be wrong about other things as well.
I mean, that's awesome. The thing I like about the North Pole is you're basically at the top of the world.
Yeah, you are.
So when you think about the world is pretty much spinning on that point.
Yeah, yeah.
You're spinning around quicker than anything. Right. Yeah. You're like, ah, why aren't you dizzy?
Why am I? No, it was. There's a place just beyond it, which is about a day or so beyond it, called Isaacson Mine. Creepiest place in the world, man. And that's where there's a runway where we got picked up from.
Right.
And there's like maybe 8 or 9 porter cabins. I think they used to mine stuff there or do weather stations or something. And back in the 80s, they had a call that just said, pack up and leave. And you can look through windows now and there's still clothes left in some of these porter cabins. And as you're walking through, every now and then you get the sense that you're being watched. You're like, what was that? And you'd look and underneath the porter cabins, there's a gap. So you're like, oh, I wonder if something's under there watching me. But it's the creepiest place. But all of these just added to the kind of atmosphere of the place. Beautiful, awesome. Amazing, scary place.
What was the hardest thing that whole trip? I mean, it was 400 miles. That's a pretty, that's a feat in itself. Without the snow, without the ice, without the temperature.
I didn't get a single blister. So I had almost survivor's remorse, or whatever you want to call it. When I watched my teammates binding their feet every night, I was like, well, maybe I can just put a bit of tape on here just so I can be part of the team. But I didn't have a single, I didn't get a single blister. The hardest part of the whole thing was, I found this little baby muskox, which is, for anyone that doesn't know, it's like a buffalo. It looks like a buffalo, but it's more closely related to like sheep and goat. But it's huge; they can weigh up to 400 kilos.
Big hairy things, isn't they? Yeah,
big dark brown hairy thing. I found a baby one stuck on a ledge, and I'm always finding these animals that need rescuing. And I remember I climbed up on this ledge and I rescued this animal, and I pushed him back up to the top, and I thought, yeah, he's going to run off and join the herd. But then he just rushed back down and he knocked me down. We both fell back. And at that moment, he just programmed himself to me. If I took a step to the left, he would take a step to the left. And every now and then it tried to feed. And I was like, look, I can't feed you because I don't have the thing that's needed to feed. And I remember the hardest part of the whole trip was, it was only a few days old. And by day 2, day 3, it started to fall behind. It was crying and it was struggling to keep up with us. And I remember hearing this thing crying for an hour or so, maybe even more, while we were walking away from it, because we couldn't stop for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we contemplated just putting a round in its head and just putting it out of its misery. But then it's like, let nature take its course. We might, you know, it might be lucky enough to find its herd. And emotionally, it was so tough for me to let that little, to hear that little animal crying in the background as we're walking away from it. And it felt, it was a really, really difficult thing to do. It was. I don't know why it was so difficult, because it was an animal, but for me I was in a position of responsibility for this animal.
Yeah. Well, the animal looked to you, didn't it? Yeah, yeah.
It looked to me as, this guy is my carer. And I thought, everything about me, I try and be a decent human being.
Yeah.
And by me abandoning this animal, does that make me less of a decent human being? And I started to think about a lot of different things, man. And that was that was really tough for me.
Ooh. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
I'm a big animal fan.
Yeah, of course.
The North Pole's done.
Yeah.
Did, I mean, you mentioned it earlier. Was it to do with ethnicity? Was it because you are, you know, the first Black Briton to have done it? Was it all about that, or was it more about the naysayers?
For me, Jace, when I first decided, when I said, yes, I'm going to do it, I didn't think about colour. Most of my life, colour is never something that comes into my mind, you know what I mean? My best friend in school was an Irish kid and a Greek boy. They've been my best friends for years. Stavros, he's still my best friend up to today. Mm-hmm. The first time I'd eaten at anyone's house, it was an Asian kid. First time I ate at anyone's house in this country was an Asian kid. I have people in my family from all over. I found out 2 years ago, my great-grandfather is white and Scottish. For me, it was... I know. So I'm going to start wearing... I think I'm allowed to wear a kilt now. I don't know if I've got the legs for it.
You just need to find out the clan and then you can get it on, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to do some digging. But I don't know if my legs are kilt legs. I might have to bulk up, like, thinking up socks or something.
I haven't got kilt legs either. Yeah, nah,
well, I might not follow the kilt route then. But for me, it was never about being the first Black or the only Black or one Black. It was just, I want to do this to show people around me that actually you don't need to be limited by the things that you've seen done.
Yeah.
You can actually reach beyond what you've seen and try and do something which is a little bit abstract and a little bit abnormal. Because many of my friends...
We're all individuals, though, aren't we in the end? It doesn't need to be about... any of that. It's just like, if you can do it and you want to do it, go and do it.
If you can do it and you want to do it, exactly, go and do it. And for me, it was like, I just want to carve out a new route, man. I don't care about you if you're Black, white, green. You can be whatever color you are. If you're a cool person, we can chill. And so when I first said I was going to do this, and I, you know, started doing the research, like I said, 10 minutes on Google, and I found this guy, Matthew Henson, who's the first person apparently to walk there, I thought to myself, well, actually, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's all I thought. That's pretty cool. I didn't think he's Black, I'm Black, it's cool. And it's just, as I read more, this guy was estranged from his parents, and I hadn't spoken to my mum for years at that point. I've spoken to you more in the last minute than I have my dad my whole life. So, I'm estranged from my parents.
Yeah.
This guy's really good with his hands. He's a carpenter. I'm pretty good with my hands. I build things too.
And decent mopeds.
Yeah. When once I've test driven it, yeah. But that was it. For me, it was more looking at this guy and saying, he's a good role model. He's a good example of what you can do. Remember, he was a Black man doing this back in 1909. And for him, the challenges must have been huge. So I somehow just equated his challenges to mine. Maybe the fractions were a little bit smaller in my case. But the fact is, I look to this person as someone who's going through or had gone through something that I was now hoping to go through.
Yeah, yeah.
And he happened to be Black. My biggest role model in life was David Attenborough.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to meet him.
No way.
I was lucky enough to meet him.
Awesome.
He's my biggest role model. It's never been about colour. And a lot of what I do now is built around inner city young people who live on estates and who are going through difficult times. And they tend to be Black, younger Black kids, because aspirations within the Black diaspora seems to be geared in a direction which isn't focused on the outdoors.
Yeah.
And many of us, we come from heritages where the outdoors was part and parcel of life.
Yeah, of course,
life.
Yeah.
And I just want to bring that community back to it if possible.
Like a reconnect.
Yeah, man, reconnect. Listen, you have the most fun, the health benefits, the joys, the pleasure, the mental health. All these things are positives that you get from being in the outdoors. And I think it can be part of the arsenal that we use to tackle all the youth violence.
I think it is the main weapon for tackling it, really. Because then, I mean, I live in London.
Yeah.
But my saviour whenever anything sort of gets a bit too much is to get out and like go out with, whether it's friends or on my own, and just reconnect with the great outdoors.
There's something that you get out there as well. It's that little moment of peace, isn't it? It's I can breathe again. It's not so loud. There isn't so much ambient noise. I'm not so stressed. It's a space where you're free to just be the real version of yourself. You don't have to have this bravado. You don't have to put on this front. And you don't have to put on masquerade as being extra tough for a moment. You're just be yourself.
The funny thing is like all these young kids, they're looking for purpose and they're looking to belong to something, but actually our purpose as humans and what we belong to is the great outdoors.
Absolutely.
And I think that's why it feels good.
Yeah, man. I mean, I've taken hundreds of young people out into the woodland areas, and the experience is always the same. They come back saying, oh, that was cool, innit? Nah, I feel all right. And I've had people wake up in the morning coming out of their tent saying, I didn't sleep. I had a crap night's sleep. How'd you feel? Nah, I feel good, though. I feel all right.
Yeah.
And it's that I don't have to look over my shoulders today.
Yeah,
I don't
have
to worry about, you know, what's going to happen in my estate or the estate or the kids down the road.
Yeah.
So it's a positive all round.
That's awesome. I mean, that's awesome. Yeah. But what's next?
Oh,
there's big things, isn't there, on the horizon?
So there's a couple of things on the horizon. Thanks for asking. as of the middle of November this year, me and my teammate Phoebe Smith, amazing woman, we're going to be doing a walk from a place called Dunnet Head, which is northern Scotland, north coast of Scotland.
Yeah, yeah.
All the way down to Lizard Point in Cornwall. We're doing that all through Christmas to, one, raise awareness of some of the things that's happening here in the UK, some of the initiatives taking place up and down the country,
yep,
or the United Kingdom. Also to raise awareness and money for our trip across Antarctica next year, which we've entitled Penguins to Pole. Because I would challenge you to find me an animal with a tougher life than a penguin.
I don't think there is.
I don't think there is either. I think it's great that we have so many great ambassadors for the world of adventure, and I think we just need to open it up a little bit more and make the industry much bigger. Actually, it can be only benefit the world.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think if we get more people loving the world, we'll get more people working to protect it for future generations, my kids, your kids, and you know, everyone else to follow us. And also we're going to be so that's next year. We're doing the Antarctic crossing, and interestingly we've mapped it so the route from Dunnet Head to Lizard Point will be roughly the same distance that we'll be covering in Antarctica, which is 1,300 or so kilometres.
Awesome.
And the following year, we're going to take 20 young people from across the UK to Antarctica so they can set foot on the Greek continent themselves.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
I've never been there. I want to go. Nah.
You can qualify as one of the young people.
I live in London.
Yeah, that's
a city.
Cool. Yeah, no, that's cool. We'll sneak under the radar. Somehow.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway. I look young.
Yeah, you look. You do. You
yeah,
look, how old are you? 22.
Yeah, there's a look of humour on his face at the moment.
No, this is my serious face. This
right,
is my, this is my serious face.
Well, mate, it's been awesome. So, Penguins to Pole.
Penguins to Pole. You
is
can
the
check us
next
out.
One.
Yeah. So, if you want to know more about that, you can just go to teamwe2.com.
Teamwe2.com.
Yeah. And all the information about that's up there. Yeah, man.
It's mate, just, that's just, awesome.
Yeah.
Listen, you're an inspirational guy.
No,
and
man,
I've mega enjoyed it.
Do you know what? Thanks a lot. And I think giving me this opportunity to talk to you and maybe talk to listeners as well, I think it's great because I just want more people to get out there and just get over that inhibition of maybe there's people out there that don't look like me or come from. Forget all that crap,
yeah.
Man. I've never had a bad experience in the outdoors. Yeah, it's cold. Yeah, it's miserable. But that doesn't make it bad. It's always just been brilliant, positive experiences.
Mate, you're awesome.
Thanks a lot.
It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Absolutely.
Thanks
pleasure.
A lot, mate.
Thank
Cheers.
You.
This podcast is supported by Talisker, the single malt whiskey, who are a brilliant brand with a message of reconnecting with the great outdoors, which is what we're all about. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and follow me and the Book of Man on Instagram and follow hashtag Jason Fox Wild Tales for the latest news. And I'll see you all later.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.